Ireland's Classic Hits Radio, talking to chartered psychologist Dr. Mark Rackley today. He is based in London, but wait till you hear him speaking. You'll be like, that's not a London accent. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Hello, Trina. How are you? I'm not putting on this accent either.
So you're a dub. You're a dub who went to London.
I am a dub who went to London. I went for 3 months and 15 years later, I'm still here.
Oh,
so don't ask me how that happened, but there you go. Such is life.
Well, thanks for fitting us in. I know it's very hard to get an appointment, actually, with Dr. Mark, because you're very, very busy, I know.
If you're not a busy psychologist in London, you're doing something terribly wrong.
Really?
The demand for what we do is ferocious, yeah. So it's mental health, so.
Can I ask you, like, up front, what would be the main issues that people will be coming to you about?
So I kind of cover a lot because I'm an adolescent and an adult psychologist. So I cover kind of like lots of different disorders, I suppose is what we call them, mental health illnesses. So a lot of depression and anxiety. I also see lots of ADHD. I do a lot in eating disorders. So they're very, sadly, very, very common. Things like when people are going through like bereavements, I also treat PTSD, OCD. So it's a real mixed bag, actually. Mm. But probably the most common ones, I suppose, would be depression and anxiety, just because depression will be the number one illness that's predicted to be in the world in the next 10 years. So
we were only talking about that on the show a couple of weeks ago, particularly amongst men, I guess, as well. There's so many men affected by anxiety and depression, isn't there?
There is. There's lots of men. And also, it's kind of ageless, that one, Trina. So, like, I have teenagers that are sat in my office and we're treating them for depression and anxiety. So it's one of those ones where even, like, children can be diagnosed with anxiety. So, yeah, it's just that one kind of runs across the board, really. So you see lots of, men and women and all ages, sadly, coming in with that diagnosis.
And do some people say to you, they're all snowflakes, they need to just, they haven't a clue what a hard life is like, they need to get on with it. You must hear that, do you?
I do, I do, like, and even sometimes people will come in and say, like, I don't know why I'm here, and I'm like, well, you're here because you're not well. So, like, it can be that even somebody themselves would be like, they'll downplay what's going on, and like, I suppose, sadly, not everywhere, but there's still a bit of a stigma around mental health, and people think I should be strong enough to be able to deal with that, or they're embarrassed, just particularly see that with men, or there's that idea that you should be strong enough to fix yourself, and that's just not possible. If that was the case, I wouldn't have a job. So, like, that's not always possible, and sometimes, like, it gets to the point where you do need to get the doctors involved. So, it can be that kind of narrative, which is really unhelpful, actually, because if the person could fix themselves, they would.
Nobody wants to be unwell. We heard a lot, actually, recently, obviously, because the very sad passing of Liam Payne, we heard a lot about, you know, he suffered quite a bit with anxiety and depression, and other people might say, well, why did he have that? I mean, he had everything. He had everything in the world. He had no financial problems. Everybody wanted to be his friend. But there could be so much loneliness in that as well.
There absolutely can be. Yeah. And that's the thing, like, with mental health, it's not like you can't position it in terms of the context of somebody's life, because that's not the factor that keeps you well. So you can be super wealthy, but you can still be unwell because of the other things that are going on in that life. And that's the thing, like, you can't look at things at face value, because if you look at, like, people who say have been very successful and have had incredible wealth, like Amy Winehouse comes to mind, Britney Spears, like, they all had very bad mental health, and that's a well-told story, that it's not, you know, what you see on the outside is not reflective of what's happening in somebody's head. So, you know, you can never go on the idea, well, you know, if you have a privileged life or you have fame, that it's going to protect you from bad mental health, because it just isn't the case.
And being in London, I'm sure you kind of see it all. You must get plenty of wealthy clients coming in that need your help.
Oh, totally, totally. It's funny because obviously I did all my training in Dublin, and I worked in Dublin as well, and then I moved over here in 2008. And it was God, talk about having your eyes opened. Like, I'd never lived in London before, obviously. And London is just like, it was the city of 10 million. It's super diverse and multicultural. And also, you have a whole different type of demographic and a whole different kind of culture over here. And yeah, like, I'd see people from all kinds of backgrounds as patients of mine in London. And I can say with absolute certainty that wealth does not protect you from mental health. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mark, we're going to talk to you about a topic that I'm sure so many of our listeners are dealing with on a daily basis in their households. And this is ADHD. So Dr. Mark Rackley is a chartered psychologist, as we said, there in London. And I know you've got your podcast as well, your mental health podcast called I Have Issues, which we'll tell people about at the very end. But in terms of ADHD, so is this... I just keep hearing an awful lot of people being diagnosed with this, adults as well, of late. What exactly is ADHD?
Great question. Let's break it down. The letter stands for, obviously, four different words. It's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So somebody who has ADHD, we're doing loads of research on this. So what we know is it's a neurodevelopmental condition, which means you're born with it. And it's one of the most hereditary conditions that there is. The hereditary percentage being 80%, so super, super high in terms of if there's a person that, you say one of your parents has ADHD, then there's an 80% chance that that will be passed down to the next generation.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Mark, actually, because a lot of people, like celebrities and stuff that have been diagnosed with ADHD, they've only found out because their children have been diagnosed. And during that process, they were like, this sounds a bit familiar. And then the adult got diagnosed after the children.
Totally. Trina, I'll give you a laugh. Like, when I am in my office, like, I don't do the ADHD assessments. I send them to my mates because they're quite detailed. So I send them to my psychiatry friends to do those. But if I have a young person in my office and I think this is undiagnosed ADHD, I'll say, listen, I think we need to check this out, and I'll tell them why. And probably 9 times out of 10, when I do that, the mom or dad will say, I think I have that. Like, I see that all the time. And like that again, where when you explain it and you explain the hereditary piece and you kind of explain how it behaves, you can see the parent going,
This is ringing a bell.
Ticking
all the boxes.
And which is great because you can almost kill two birds with one stone in that, where in some cases you're sending, you know, your patient, which is the child in the family, the teenager, and the parent is going to have to get assessed as well. So it can actually be really beneficial for the young person to realize, actually, you know, it's not just me, and this is something that is in my family. So, and in some cases as well, you'll have a young person who comes in and they'll already say, oh, my mom or dad has ADHD, or my sister has, or whatever. So so we're understanding it more and more. But to come back to what you were saying, so what is it?
Yeah.
So from what we know, you're born with it. It's neurodiversity, so that particular brain is wired a certain way, as opposed to a brain that doesn't have ADHD. And so the breakdown is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So that person has a problem with their attention, their concentration, their focus. So it might be very hard for them to stay on a particular task, or they get distracted easily. There can be the hyperactivity piece. So what that is, it's hypermobility, that the person might be super fidgety, or they're kind of walking up around the room, that kind of thing. So there's a hyperactivity part. Not everybody has that, I should say. Some can have ADHD without the hyperactivity piece.
Is it a case where you could be a very messy person? You wouldn't be able to focus on completing a task. So you might say, this sounds like me now. Jeez, you might put on the wash, right? And the laundry is washed, but it's sitting in the machine for 2 days. You never get around to actually drying it and putting it away and all that.
It can be that. Yeah. So what that, again, that's about losing focus. So you can start a task and then you'll go off and make a cup of tea, or you'll doom scroll on your phone, or
so
you'll
gets done
get distracted.
Then.
Yeah, you get distracted with something. So what you have is a load of tasks that have been started, and then they just never get completed. And it's okay, well, there'll always be something more interesting to do. So if you need to kind of unload the dishwasher or put your washing away, that's not stimulating enough for a brain with ADHD. That's boring. Yeah. So you're not going to, your brain isn't actually going to go, oh, hey, let's do that. It will always find something more interesting to do. So the non-stimulating, kind of boring tasks get left, and sometimes they can get left for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So it's the fact that it can be very difficult to complete the task just purely for that reason, because of how the brain behaves.
And even financially, it can be a little bit wild with your finances. Like, you get paid on a Friday and the money's gone by the Sunday, even though you need to make it last for a month almost, because you just kind of go, oh, there's something nice and shiny and new, I'll take that please, and forget about the bills almost.
Totally.
I'm saying this now because I had a guest on the show, I think it was last year, and she was telling me all these things that she noticed in herself, and she went off and got diagnosed then with ADHD, and she said it all made sense to her.
That's the thing, and it does all make sense. So when we explain it to people and we break it down properly, it never comes as a shock to people or a surprise. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, it does make sense. And a lot of times it's actually very comforting and reassuring for that person to realise, well, there's a reason why this is happening. So it's not that I'm, a lot of times sometimes with people with ADHD, they can think they're lazy or they're not smart enough or that they're somehow, there's a problem with them. And it's not. The problem is with the wiring in the brain. So if you have a brain that's wired a certain way, then it's going to play itself out in your life. So when you explain that to people and you help them understand, then actually it's really helpful so that they can then start to work differently with the way their brain behaves.
Now, we want to talk about parenting teenagers and, young people who have ADHD, because I guess it's an extra challenge. It's hard enough, I guess, when you're parenting teenagers, but when ADHD is thrown in as well, it can be extra challenging, I'm sure.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, definitely. It's one of the big things I hear is when we get the diagnosis done and we say, okay, this is what we're dealing with. Now, when you're dealing with teenagers, you are obviously involving the parents in the treatment because you kind of have to. You're not doing family therapy with them, but you are working with the parents as well in terms of them supporting their young person. But it's a massive challenge for parents because there's no manual for this. There's no, they haven't done any training or in parenting a teenager with ADHD. And it is different because a young person with ADHD sadly can have unique challenges going through the teenage years that somebody who doesn't have ADHD will have. And that can be obviously really hard for them, for the young person, but massive challenge for their parents. And of course, when we bring the young person to treat the treatments, then we're treating them. So in some cases, they'll be on medication to help their brain to be able to get through the day. And then they're seeing me to deal with the whole psychological piece of it. Well, we're not giving the parents any treatment. Like, the parents can be really kind of feel helpless, like, what do we do? Yeah. It can be very difficult. So, like, some of the cases of ADHD that I would treat, Trina, like, the young person might start refusing to go to school. They might be engaging in really impulsive behaviours, like taking drugs, or very reckless behaviour in terms of staying out late at night and not telling their parents where they are. One of the symptoms of ADHD is what we call emotional dysregulation, which means they can kind of lose control of their emotions or be prone to kind of meltdowns. And also the opposite, getting very sad and getting very upset. So it can be, again, really difficult. Like, if you see a teenager with ADHD, as I have many times, have a moment of emotional dysregulation, it's tough because they basically start to, there's a lot of anger. The words that come out of their mouth will be horrendous, and they will say and do all kinds of things, and then stops. So it can be very difficult parenting a teenager who has ADHD for all of those reasons.
And the parents must feel like they just can't cope with this at all. They end up feeling depressed themselves.
Parents of their kids, and you know, they just want to do what's best for their kids, and they can feel very kind of helpless and hopeless, actually. So like sometimes when I'm treating a case of that, I will bring the parents in with the young person. I'll say, listen, this is what I think. We'll have a collaborative conversation around what's going on, the challenges that are happening in the life of the teenager. And a lot of the times the parents, of course, is like they don't understand the condition, or they're learning as they go. So a big part of it, you know, certainly what I try and do with the parents is educating them, like this is why this is happening, and explaining to them what they're seeing with their teenager. So when they have the educational piece, then at least they have context in terms of thinking, well, they're just being a bit of a nightmare. That isn't the case. It might be sometimes, but there's an underlying factor in terms of their brain chemistry and wiring. And once you've got that educational piece in, then you can help the young person and the parent to then figure out some interventions that can work when the parent sees the young person maybe engaging in reckless behavior, or if they're having a moment of emotional dysregulation, then how the parent and the young person can support each other to work through that. So it can actually work really nicely when you get the parents on board and get them educated in what's going on, and you get the teenager working along with them.
So it's not like, you know, so your average teenager, you know, they're causing a bit of trouble and you say, cut this out now or else you won't be going out for the next month. I mean, it's, you can't really do that when a teenager has ADHD. So how do you, I don't know, not punish the behaviour because there's nothing they can do about it, but yeah, what will your tips be to what to do in those scenarios?
I think it's very important that, like, in terms of how I work with it is, I explain to the young person what happens when they're, say, wanting to engage in risky behaviour, or when they're wanting to, when they're seeking basically stimulation. So what you're helping the young person to understand is their ADHD. So you're really getting them to become an expert on themselves. Two main things, I suppose, what I hear from my young people is if they're bored or if they're tired. Now, boredom and tiredness with ADHD are kind of like, they're the danger spaces. Because if they're bored, they're going to look for stimulation. If that's negative stimulation, they don't care because they're just looking for stimulation. So that could be something destructive or reckless. So understanding, like, if you're bored, then we introduce an intervention where you go and do something that is going to positively stimulate you, or again, you tell the parent, I'm feeling bored, and then the parent helps distract and works the young person through that. And then if they're tired, then again, understand that if you're tired, you're going to be more prone to the emotional dysregulation piece, which means it's going to be hard. You might be a bit scratchy and you might be a bit prone to being snappy and overreacting. But again, identifying the context. If you're tired, and you let your parents know that, and again, we walk through how to help the young person then manage that day and to adjust. So you're constantly monitoring, and you're getting the young person to monitor themselves, and then you're getting the parent in as a support, and getting the young person to use the parent as a support so that it can be managed. Because if it's not managed, it can get very chaotic, and you know, and it's not ideal then, because the young person is dysregulating, or they're engaging in maybe destructive behaviours, and then the parents are reacting to that. So that can be really kind of problematic.
So if they're bored, Mark, then would you be recommending that they take part in a good few activities, like, you know, doing sports or whatever, that will keep them going and keep them busy a lot?
Definitely, yeah. So what you're looking for there with boredom is you're looking for then, okay, let's look at what we might be able to give your brain to do, something to give your brain to do to stimulate it. So absolutely, that can be exercise. We tend to use a variety of interventions there, Trina. So that might be where the young person might, again, it all depends on the young person. They might go and see one of their friends, or they take the dog for a walk, or they go and do some exercise. They might do some art, play some music. They might go and cook something, or it can just be something as simple as having a conversation with somebody. So it all depends on kind of the level of boredom, but absolutely, we don't want to leave the young person in that bored state, because then they're more vulnerable to maybe doing something a bit more for negative stimulation. It's very personal, that one. So we work out between myself, the young person, and their parent, what we can do, or the variety of interventions that we can use in those moments when the young person is bored. Yeah.
So sleep is very important then as well, because you mentioned being tired. Having a routine. Would you need to be having a proper, you know, bedtime kind of and waking time and all that?
Definitely. So the problem young people associated with ADHD have with sleep is when, not all, by the way, I should say that some of my patients with ADHD are brilliant sleepers. They're great and there's not an issue for them. So I don't want to say it's everybody with ADHD has this. They don't. But sometimes with the ones that struggle at night time, when of course it's quiet, there's a lack of stimulation in the environment. So the brain can then go looking for stimulation if it's not quite ready yet to fall asleep. So that's the point where the young person can be on their phone or they're struggling to fall asleep because the brain is looking for stimulation at a time when it really should be sleeping. We do try and put a sleep routine into place. So it's basically no devices an hour before bedtime. We look at how to help the young person relax before bedtime. So that's around kind of winding down and creating a space where it's conducive to sleep. And then we keep that routine in place as much as we can. The thing that works quite nicely is white noise. White noise is like that kind of natural sounds, like kind of crashing waves or rainfall, like the wind.
Things that make me need to go for a wee, Mark, basically, is what you're saying.
Some of those things that get you up in the night, yeah. So if you're not into white noise, and so white noise doesn't stimulate the brain, it relaxes it. So that's why you can fall asleep on the beach, because the rhythmic nature of the sound of the waves actually calms you and it can gently sedate the brain. So with some of my young people, we'll just play the white noise all night. So the brain is attending to the noise, but it's not stimulating the brain, it's relaxing it.
Now, how do the young people feel about going in to see you? Are they open to it, or do you find some of them don't want to be there?
I would say that's a real mixed bag. Some of them are brilliant. Like one of the questions I always ask, even if they've been referred by, like most of my work is referred to GPs and psychiatrists, I'll say to, in the parent context, I'll say, is your child up to this? So what you want to see is, have they bought in that they need to see a psychologist? And some are like, yeah, they're great, they can't wait, like they totally want this. And with some young people, it's a no, that this is the last place they want to be. And unfortunately, like, they are young adults, you can't mandate that they come to your office. So if the young person hasn't bought in and if they're resistant, then unfortunately you're not going to get them into the office. That just won't happen. I've had many a parent in tears on the phone to me saying they won't go. So it just depends on the attitude of the young person, their openness, and also their willingness to appreciate that I need that help. Yeah.
There you have it. ADHD. I hope that was of some help to parents who are parenting teenagers with ADHD, and you might even recognise some of your own kind of behaviour in that as well. And many parents, as Mark was saying there, have ADHD and they might not even have been diagnosed themselves. Is it easy to get diagnosed, or is it quite a lengthy kind of thing? I know it's different over where you are in London, Mark, but you must be familiar with it over here in Ireland too.
Well, I know, even because I get to do all my friends, so I kind of keep in touch with my mates over there. And my brother is he is a psychotherapist over there, and he specializes in ADHD and autism. So yeah, unfortunately the wait can be long, and even seeing somebody privately, the wait can be very long, just because the demand is so high, and also the assessment process is quite thorough. So like, the assessment process might take a couple of weeks, because you're collating all the information from the various parties, and then you're writing up the assessment. So because the assessments aren't done quickly and they're quite thorough, because they need to be in order for them to be robust, then unfortunately, the weights can be quite significant, unfortunately, yeah.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you very much for coming on. A dub living in London, and we're talking all about ADHD. There's no getting away with that accent, is there?
Thanks for having me, Gina.
Thanks a million. It's Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.